Session number 18493, Reel 12.
Arnold Lupton, Reel 12. Did anybody receive any food parcels?
I don't remember anybody receiving any food parcels. No, even the South African ones didn't. But I think in England there wouldn't have been anybody with any spare food anyway to send out. And you'd have to be awfully careful with the packaging to... And I don't know whether in those days you could have done it properly.
On the food front, just quickly again, you said very often you would get a... weeks on end where you had the same boring stuff. But were there favourites and unfavourites amongst the majority of you?
Well, that's the main thing was that whatever it was, you were glad to have the food. It was just that when you kept having the same stuff literally day after day without any break, you did get awfully fed up wondering how you could vary the flavour or whatever. But I know when you first got something new, like the tongue, or you got the herrings or pilchards or whatever they were, or even bully beef occasionally, something like that. For a few days, oh, that's wonderful, but naturally you go off it after several days.
So bully beef wasn't a staple, it was a rarity, was it, from what you just said?
Yes, it turned up occasionally, but it wasn't a regular thing. Let's say there was less of that than there was of some of the other funny things that you seem to get plenty of. And then we got some weird jams from South Africa, so tomato jam and melon jam and things like this. They're pretty, well, they weren't revolting. You didn't know what to do with them because they were so tasteless. Perhaps put the melons in something that you wanted for a sweet, or put the tomatoes in to try and sweeten something else up. It was weird. Yeah, that was supposed to be jam. And I know melon and ginger was a very favourite one. That came from South Africa too. But you'd get the occasional 7-pound can of marmalade or something from Britain. But it was very mixed, you know, where our food came from and what it amounted to. But on the whole, well, it was satisfying enough.
Did you get the famous M and V?
Meat and veg. You get the odd tin of M and V. Yes, you could make yourself just a big heap of M and V, you know, meat and veg mixture, cook it up and have a good Dixieful. That did make a break occasionally. But as I say, one of the main horrors was these horrible sweet potatoes that we were always getting dished out with, because they thought we needed potatoes. We did, but not them.
Going back to your water situation, I mean, that is potentially quite difficult to manage without adequate water supplies.
Yeah.
I mean, what about your tanks? What kind of... Did they need water? I'm thinking about radiators and things.
They were water-cooled. On the whole, they didn't lose a vast amount of water. Mind you, we weren't, we didn't normally go very far when we moved. Some, well, a few miles, but I mean nothing vast. And they did occasionally need some water. If you got one that was leaking in any way, then of course you'd got the fitters up to come and make a quick and proper job of that. But generally, we didn't seem to get a great amount of water loss from the vehicles, although they were all water cooled.
How did that work? Was it some kind of a closed system, or what?
It was really similar to a car engine. Well, it was basically a big car engine, lorry engine or whatever, which had a, yes, it was a closed system. And if we had driven very many miles, of course, you probably would have lost a fair amount or certain amount in the form of steam, because you couldn't keep in all of the steam in the engine. But with not doing fast mileages normally, you didn't get any great loss there. That would come up in a separate supply on the water wagon to tanks which had expressed a need for it.
So this is a completely separate supply? Was it a different
kind
of water?
It wasn't. Well, it came, yes, it wasn't such good water, let's say. The drinking water was a bit better quality, and it had had pellets thrown in it to supposedly make it purer. Whereas when it came up for the tanks, it was just the straightforward water out of one of the wells which are scattered around the desert.
Muddy water for the tank and chlorine for the men.
Yes. Yes.
Was it about this time, and we're talking about around about June 1941, this was about the time of one of the operations against the Germans, am I correct?
That's right, yes. When we decided, or the generals in charge decided, that we should push them back and relieve the pressure on Tobruk at the same time.
Was this Battle Axe?
Battle Axe, yes. And we were not far from the, on the Egyptian side of the wire dividing it from Libya. So we went in and we could see some of their tanks, but they were too far off for our two-pounders to reach, well, to reach in any state that they could do any damage to them. And so we waited almost, not quite hull down, but as low as possible on the horizon until they got somewhat nearer. But unfortunately, in our case, they must have had a six-pounder or something, and they fired a shot which went right through the front of our tank. Didn't immediately kill the tank commander, but he did die shortly after. I was very fortunate because we had a little bloke on our tank who was half Chinese, half English, Charlie Gibbs, who used to call him Charlie Chan, but he didn't mind in those days either. And we had no radio on our tank, so he had decided that he would like to sit in the gunner's position, whilst I sort of squatted on the floor and loaded if any loading had to be done. And with him being a lot shorter than me, very much shorter than me, he got a bit of a cut on his head where this thing, some of the metal flew out. I only got a cut here while I was sat on the floor. The shell which had come in was a solid shell, and it just clanked around in the back of the tank where the radio would have been. I had it for quite a long time, that shot. And so we had to move out to take the tank commander for treatment, if possible. We found the medical officer's place out of reach of the front line, and took him out of the tank, but he died very shortly after. And
so where were you hit?
Well, it was up above the, just above the gunner's position.
Through the front of the turret?
Yes. Which I would have had to myself. Well, tank commander too, but being in my size, I would have got it.
So what was it physically like when that thing hit?
Very difficult to say. It was unpleasant when we saw the tank commander state he was in, and he collapsed. Everybody else was very relieved, you might say, to still be in one piece, and the tank also, it had a hole through it, but it hadn't had it in the engine or in the driver's place. So
did it rock back? Was there a, you know, was a,
well, it must have had a certain, yes, stoppage effect. We were stopped at that time, not moving. It was just a bang and pings of bits of metal flying all around the place, and it was a funny sensation. Difficult to explain it, really.
And your tank commander was hit by the shell or some of the shrapnel, or
both, all the lot, yeah. Right through the arm with the shell and various other bits and pieces all over him. And some of it was fatal. Yes, sardine wall, I think. Yes.
And you pulled back and
we
went to the
MO. We pulled back and went to the MO, yes, who was just a couple of miles back somewhere.
How did you, I mean, did you sort of tell anyone that's what you were doing and why, or did you just do it?
We just did it, because we had no radio, nothing. I mean, any signals which there had been hand signals, but the tank commander was in the way of making any signals anyway. So, no, we just went. And then were able to tell somebody later on, you know, that we'd had to pull out because of that.
So what happened immediately after you got him to the MO? I mean, somebody helped you get him out of the turret and...
Yes, we all between us more or less got him out of the turret. Laid him down on a ground sheet at the side, and the MO came to look at him, and he sort of died while he was looking at him.
So what about the rest of you? What was your next move?
Well, I only needed a bit of a patch on the neck, and the Charlie Gibbs, he needed a bit of a patch on his head. And then we were told to stay back until they got a new man in to command it. We didn't go in again that day, as far as I remember.
But you kept the same tank with the hole in it?
Yes, yes. Yes, there weren't any spares.
And where that had come in, I mean, it hadn't, I mean, it sounds like it might have taken away your sight, your gun sight.
No, it was above that. It just came through, well, there was just a little view thing there, and it came through alongside that and sort of smashed that up, and nothing else really, apart from a few split pins and things that had flown around and other bits of metal.
Must have been quite traumatic staying in the same vehicle, going back into the line again.
It was really, but we had to do it on two or three occasions in the desert anyway. Yes, we, well, you just had to get used to that because, as I say, there were no reserves to fill up, and these, that's when we really used to say that you could just about blow sand through the tin cans as we had in those days with a 2-pounder, which was useless unless you were right alongside the side of them or something.
But your very first taste of action in a tank as a gunner,
You
never got to fire a round, is that right? And no. you were taken out at long range.
Yes. Oh yes. Couldn't tell where the tank was that had fired the shot that came through ours. It was, I don't know how many, 3,000 yards or something distance. I don't think our 2-pounder shot could even have reached it, never mind done anything to it. You were usually talking about 500, 600, 800 yards maximum, you know, to do any good with a 2-pounder.
So you went back in again, what, the day after, did you say?
Yes. Went back in again then, and, we had various skirmishes around about. That was one occasion when we found shooting on the move and moving around did do us well against German tanks, Mark 3s and Mark 4s. The 3s normally had the 6-pounders on, the 4s had 75mm, but they, if we got around the side or the back, you could usually do some damage to them. If they couldn't, well, they just couldn't fire properly on the move.
Could you explain how it, I mean, how it sort of felt and doing this manoeuvring? I mean, what did it look like from your point of view through your little telescope?
Well, it was a case of sort of jinxing. You do a quick burst there and then go over there somewhere and moving around. If you were amongst a few of their tanks, you got different views of them as you went around, and you fired when you could see something to fire at in a position that you felt you could hit.
You'd made the decision to fire, did you, as the gunner?
Yes. The tank commander couldn't say that in that position where the tank was at that moment you were going to make a hit. You had to decide it, yes, I can do that one and have a go at it. Then you'd probably hit a bump, but still, that's just one of those things.
So what's it like inside that turret when you're not closed down exactly, because I assume your commander's looking out, but I mean, what's it like inside that turret when you're firing your gun?
Well, there's considerable engine noise, which is going on all the time, of course. There's the occasional sound of your 2-pounder firing, or maybe a machine gun if you're defended what the target was you were looking at the time. And you don't think about whether something is going to hit you or not. You're just sitting there and doing your thing as you go zooming around and when you can. And as I say, there's a colossal noise of the engine going on all the time. And that is a distraction in itself, in a way.
But a distraction, not so much distraction from the job, you mean? But I mean, it
no,
takes your mind.
Yeah, it's background.
Background. Yeah.
We did have one occasion when we were doing a bit of this chinksing around, when we had a bloke who was my loader, should have been our wireless operator, but we didn't have a wireless, so he didn't have that job to do. But he was quite good at cooking the odd things, and we had been cooking a so-called rice pudding, which was mainly boiled rice with a bit of milk out of a tin put into it, because that was about all you had to do it with. And he was doing this rice pudding very nicely, and somebody called out, up, you know, into the, get in the tanks, get moving. So he had to grab hold of this Dixie off the little fire, bring it into the tank with him. Wasn't quite cooked by then. And he put it down on the floor and then stuck his big boot in it and was clattering around the turret, loading my gun with this dirty great pan on his foot. It was quite amusing in a way. We did on that occasion manage to make holes in a couple of German tanks too, even while he was clattering around the turret.
Yeah, I mean, you could actually see, that's the other thing I was going to ask you about, you know, seeing your fall of shot, seeing the, you know, seeing the effect. Could you?
Well, we were in such cases, usually close enough to be able to. I wouldn't say right up next to it, but a couple of hundred yards or so, and you could actually see if the thing hit and what it did if it did hit. Maybe broke their track, or you could see it go into the engine compartment and start a fire off, or possibly even hit the turret if you happen to hit it in the right place. Yes, you could see in those occasions what was happening, or whether you'd completely missed them because you got some sudden movement of the ground that put you off. So I think, yes, for that action, that was more or less what it amounted to. We didn't get very far in chasing the Germans off. In fact, they chased us back again eventually, but it took a few days to sort it out between us. And you get these things every now and then. We used to have them quite often in a day, when they would say there's a team of Germans working down, we'll have to go and stop them, sort them out. And so we'd have to do some of this running around them and trying to put them off coming any further.
What was this, a patrol, you mean, a German
patrol? Yes, you'd get maybe half a dozen of their tanks or something would be seen moving down, and they were probably coming just to see what there was and maybe knock something of ours out.
What about bailed out crews? Was there anything of sort of machine gunning the bailed out crews, or were they left?
Well, it's very odd, because I was in a bailed out crew once, and we were just walking across the battlefield as if we were out on a Sunday stroll. I mean, what was going on around us, it didn't seem to matter, but That just happened. Whether people were trying to machine gun us or people were just firing shots and they happened to go, you could hear them zooming past or something. You never thought until somebody picked you up on the tank and could move you back a bit. You wouldn't always, you would sometimes perhaps, if they looked as if they were still stroppy, as you might say, perhaps you would give them a burst of machine gun fire. And they would probably do it to you too, it depended. If you were moving and you were getting out of the way of another one having a go at you, then you didn't have time to bother.
So, I mean, the actual view that you were getting through your telescope, I mean, it sounds as if it must have been fairly kaleidoscopic.
Yes, it was rather, because the gunner could only see through his telescope or through a little flap which you could open. It was just, could you say it hinged, I suppose so, more or less above the position of the telescope, where you could see through and see everything. Well, you couldn't see a great amount because it was only a little piece, slightly bigger than one of those tapes. But you could see more if you got close to it than you could through your telescope. And if it was fairly quiet and you weren't likely to get a machine gun bullet or something coming whizzing in there, you could have a look around occasionally. But more often than not, all the view you got was through your telescope. It was not highly sensitive or very, you know, in a very close-knit point. You did have a bit of view around when you were looking through the telescope, in addition to having your sights on the thing you were aiming at. So it was a question of getting used to seeing what you could see, that was all.
I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is, I mean, was there any element of motion sickness? Because, I mean, that seems to be a classic trigger for motion sickness, that kind of limited view, pitching and rolling about like that.
Well, maybe gunners were tested before, sort of tested by action or whatever beforehand, that they wouldn't get any motion sickness or anything from doing this job under those conditions. But I never remember having any trouble with it. Maybe something to do with, you know, where you're looking through one eye most of the time. Maybe due to that I have this eye is a bit weaker than the other one. I don't know.
Is there any one particular thing that really sort of sums up what it was like to be in your turret during a battle? People firing back at you and you trying to knock them out. Is there anything that sums it up?
Couldn't say there's anything really strong or sticks out strongly, except the fact that when you're out there, you're doing something and you haven't time to bother about what other people may be trying to do to you. It's just survival at its rawest, I suppose, which is living and or trying to make sure you live, and you can't think of anything else except you're there doing a job And that's it.
What about fear? Were you ever scared?
I suppose you're always scared, but not so that I would really notice it, no. No, not in action in a tank. No. I suppose if I'd been in one that was brewed up or something, maybe I would, but I was in tanks which were